Hi, good afternoon, everyone. It's such a beautiful day outside. My husband has been so itching to go fishing, and he hasn't been able to, so really, really appreciate the good weather. As you know, I preach once a month, and so it seems like if you miss that one Sunday that I'm up here preaching, you don't see me preaching for like 2 months or 3 months. And so I told you the story about how this one person said that I was a fake. Well, he didn't really believe I was one of the pastors here because he came to church, we invited him, and he just always missed that one day out of the month that I was preaching. And so he never saw me up here, and he's like, I don't believe you anymore. You guys, it's just one big joke. But so I am up here, and I'm continuing to preach through my series. Pastor Q has a series that he does, and my series is through the people from the Bible, various ones that I just pray about and feel like God puts on my heart to share with you insights, things from their life that we can glean and that we can take to be able to encourage our own faith and our walk with the Lord. So today's person that I want to speak about is Daniel, but not just Daniel by himself. A lot of people just preach on Daniel, but I'm going to include his BFFs. So it's Daniel and his three friends. Let's not forget about his three friends. Now, Daniel, you know, he's one of the most famous Old Testament characters from the Bible, and one of the most famous stories that all kids know is Daniel and the Lion's Den. Who doesn't know the story of Daniel and the Lion's Den? Anyone who's grown up in the church, who've been through the Sunday school curriculum, you have heard about Daniel and the Lion's Den. The name itself, Daniel, is so incredibly popular. It is the most common name at our church. We have two elders named Daniel. We've got two guys up here on the praise team named Daniel. I actually took the time last night to look through my Facebook. I found out that I have over 25 friends named Daniel. Over 25 friends, all named Daniel, from like, you know, old high school friends to church friends and my former youth group kids in Seattle. That's how many Daniels there are. It's a very, very common name. And for some reason, Asians really like the name Daniel. And it may have something to do with the person Daniel from the Bible, if they are Christians, why people are naming their sons Daniel. I'm not sure. But it's just a very common, very well-liked name. But that's not why I want to talk about Daniel today, not because of its popularity or anything. But from the life of Daniel and his three friends, we can learn a lot about faith. We can learn a lot about conviction, especially during the times of overwhelming pressure to compromise. And that's what I want to talk today about. We live in this age of compromise. And you can see compromise as a good thing. You know, when two sides are absolutely fighting and they're at a complete stalemate, and then you say, come on, give a little here, give a little there, and let's compromise. Let's make a happy compromise. Let's meet in the middle. I'm not talking about those kind of compromise where there's reconciliation happening and each side needs to give a little bit, but I'm talking about that this age is an age of compromise. And I want to look at Daniel because his story is so relevant to us, not just for his time then, but really relevant to us now in this century. Because Daniel found himself as a child of God living in a foreign culture. A well-known Bible professor and a commentator, he wrote lots and lots of Bible commentaries. His name is D.A. Carson. He says this: the context in which the life of Daniel is set is summed up in the question asked by the exiles in Babylon. How can we sing the song of the Lord while in a foreign land? The entire book teaches us that this world will always be a foreign land to the people of God. God's people are strangers in the world, surrounded by malignant and destructive enemies. Yet it is possible to live in a way which brings praise and honor to God, just as Daniel did. And so just as Daniel in his time as a beloved child of God, he was living in a foreign land, parallels with us too. We say that we are not of this world, but we are in the world, being children of God, and this is a foreign place for us because this is not our home. So throughout life, everyone feels this pressure pressure to compromise. And this pressure comes to both Christians and non-Christians alike. We don't corner the market on this. But as Christians, often that pressure comes in the form of pressure to disobey. So many things. I know that Christianity is not about rules and do's and don'ts, but I mean, there are basic things such as the Ten Commandments and such as right and wrong and things like that. And as Christians, the pressure comes to us in the way of decisions that we have to make, temptations that come, pressures and things to disobey what we know better, to disobey our God and the things that he has set before us. If we're serious about living an obedient Christian life, we can count on, you better believe, that we can count on facing numerous situations that are going to test us, that are going to test our resolve of living this life of no compromise for the Lord. No compromise was a huge phrase back in the 80s. Keith Green, some of you who were Christians in the 80s or weren't too young back then. Keith Green was a singer, and he wrote this book called No Compromise, and it was very, very kind of life-changing for many, many people. But this phrase, no compromise, I think became famous then. And so if we're serious about living this obedient Christian life, we have to realize and count on the fact that we're going to face so many of these situations. Some will be pressured by an employer. A lot of us work. There's a lot of pressures at work, right? Some of us will feel pressure from our friends and relatives, right? Maybe our friends and relatives, whether they're Christian or not Christians, certain pressures for us to do or say or, you know, certain things. Then there are also the internal pressures that comes from our own natural desires. You all know what I'm talking about, the struggle that we feel, the internal pressure and the temptation and the challenges that we feel that wars with our soul because of our natural desires. There are the pressures of trying to get ahead, trying to get a promotion. You know, everybody's getting ahead, why not me? So maybe you have to cut corners. There's the pressures of trying to get good grades at school. Sometimes you get cut corners in terms of copying, cheating, or various things, right, to get ahead. Sometimes there's pressures, if you're a contractor or do that kind of thing at work, to land the big contract or bring in more contracts for your company, your organization, pressures involved with that. When we look at Daniel and his friends, we see that they felt the pressure to compromise. They felt the pressure to compromise their faith on many, many occasions. But they are an example to us of the conviction that they held so firmly, the faith that they held so strong in this age of compromise. And their story gives us hope for today. And their story gives us encouragement for tomorrow. So let's look at Daniel, if you all have your Bibles. We're going to be going through several chapters. Keep your Bibles open to chapter 1, 3, and 6. So here's what's happening. Let me kind of set the stage for you. God allowed King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon to defeat the nation of Israel and capture the city of Jerusalem. And this happened in 605 BC. Now, the people of God, you know that they kept going into disobedience. They fell away from the Lord. They fell into idol worship. And, you know, they were not just this perfect, straight, narrow path towards God. They were always, you know, all over the place. And so this was during one of those times when they were falling away that God allowed King Nebuchadnezzar, pagan god, a pagan king, Babylon, to defeat the nation of Israel, 605 BC. Now, Daniel and some of his friends, they were taken prisoner, and they were transported to Babylon. By the way, trivia question. Anybody know what the modern-day nation that is located in Babylon is today? What country? Yes. Of course you would know. Military man over there. Yes, I was really surprised. I did not know, and you know, I was looking it up, and I came across that information. It is modern-day Iraq. So let's look at chapter 1, verses 3 and 4. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, chief of his court officials, to bring into the king's service some of the Israelites from the royal family and the nobility, young men without any physical defect, handsome, showing aptitude for every kind of learning, well-informed, quick to understand, and qualified to serve in the king's palace. He was to teach them the language and literature of the Babylonians. The king assigned them a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. They were to be trained for 3 years, and after that, they were to enter the king's service. Among those who were chosen were some from Judah. There was Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. The chief official gave them new names. To Daniel, the name was Belteshazzar. To Hananiah, Shadrach, and to Mishael, Meshach, and to Azariah was Abednego. Now, the Hebrew word translated young men here indicates that Daniel and his friends were probably between 13 and 19 years of age. 13 and 19 years of age. They were just young teenage boys. I read several commentaries where they said that he was 14. Some said he was 16. But generally, again, the Hebrew word indicating young men was in the age between 13 and 19. And I think a lot of times when we think about these great feats and wonderful biblical people, we think of them being just, you know, mature and older. But these were young teenage boys here. And we have to understand that they have just seen their ungodly nation, they've seen this ungodly nation, the Babylonians, come and destroy their homeland. Think about the psychological trauma. Think about where their mind is in terms of, I mean, we see all the time about PTSD or when there's war and when there's so much bloodshed and families are ripped apart and there's just so much loss that happens. So think about this, that these young boys are in the state of having just seen this ungodly nation come and destroy their homeland, destroy Jerusalem. They've been forced to leave their country, right? They're removed from their families, and now they have to live in a foreign land. They have to live in this pagan, ungodly land, and they're to be trained to serve and work for a heathen king. I mean, this is as far as you can get from everything and anything that they've ever known. This is completely the polar opposite of what they know. And it's in this very environment and in this situation that Daniel and his friends were able to remain faithful to their religious commitment and convictions. They were able to remain faithful to the religious values and obedient to God. You have to wrap your mind around that. These young boys, with all the trauma, with everything that they've seen, you know, where, you know, what kind of psychological, emotional state they are in. And this is the environment where they shine as having and holding on to their religious convictions and still being obedient. So there are three specific situations that I want to look at more closely. And there were three times that Daniel and his friends were forced to make decisions of no compromise, forced to not compromise. The first one, it was about eating the king's food. It was about food. We all know about food. We enjoy good food. So this is very important to us. There was nothing wrong with the food itself physically. It was very pleasing to the eye. It was very tasty. And I'm sure it was pretty, you know, it was delicious, good food. In fact, it was the finest gourmet food. If you're into organic and all the kind of luxurious non-GMO, and it was the best. It was the best food because it comes from the king's table. So what was the problem? Well, the Old Testament scholars believe that this was meat and wine that had either first, one, been offered to Babylonian idols, so it was tainted, it was food that had first been offered to idols, or, secondly, that it was food that was declared unclean by God from ceremonially unclean animals, and they were prepared in ceremonially unclean ways. Now, we know how strict the Jewish dietary laws are. They're very strict about this whole clean and unclean business. So what do Daniel and his friends do? Let's see. Oh, did I read? Did I read this? The king assigned them a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. They were to be trained for 3 years, and after that, they were to enter the king's service. But Daniel, what did he do? He resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine, and he asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself in this way. There's a visual. It's always good to have visuals. Now, the NIV says, as I just read, because I'm preaching from the NIV uses the word he resolved. The NASB says that he made up his mind. The NLT says that he determined not to. So he resolved, he determined not to. He had made up his mind not to. Daniel refused to compromise. He took a stand very early. He didn't wait around to see what was going to happen, but instead he made up his mind early and he followed through. I think a lot of times where we fail is that when we want to resolve and make, you know, to be resolved of something and we want to not compromise, it's too late. We've gone down that slippery slope. We've already put one foot in, and so we're already on our way down. And then it's hard to kind of climb back out. And so here, from the beginning, from the very get-go, he takes a stand very early. No, just like in the picture. He doesn't wait. He doesn't taste the food first. He doesn't, you know, research it in depth. But these are the suspicions of where this food is coming from, what kind of food it is. And he resolves to not be defiled by it. So Daniel politely asks if they could eat something different. He says politely. He doesn't demand it. He doesn't throw the food in the guard's face. But he politely asks, can we have something different to eat? And he makes a deal with the guard that brings the food to them. Let's read. But the official told Daniel, I am afraid of my lord, the king, who has assigned your food and drink. Why should he see you looking worse than the other young men your age? The king would then have my head because of you. So he's afraid that he's going to get beheaded if he sees that he's not giving proper food, and Daniel and his buddies, for some reason, besides, unlike the others who are big and strong, are not growing and being healthy. And then this is Daniel. Please test your servants for 10 days. Give us nothing but vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then compare our appearance with that of the young men who eat the royal food and treat your servants in accordance with what you see. So the guard agreed to this and tested them for 10 days. At the end of the 10 days, they looked healthier and better nourished than any of the young men who ate the royal food. So the guard took away their choice food and the wine that they were to drink and gave them vegetables instead. How many of you guys would do that? When you are offered that filet mignon, when you are offered that choice ribeye steak, and you say, no, I'll just take water and the vegetables. I know the whole Daniel diet and other things and keto and all these other things, but for not for those kind of, you know, diet reasons, but because of your convictions, because of your beliefs, not because your blood pressure is high, not because you have high cholesterol, not because you're, you know, overweight or any of these things, but purely on the convictions of what you believe, you're going to say no to these choice meat and wine and things. Don't miss this part. He has amazing faith. Amazing faith. Look at this. I mean, we hear this story so often that we tend to overlook the fact that Daniel resolves to honor his God by not defiling himself with this food from the king's table. But he is so sure that God will honor him and his friends by making good on this deal, right? So he's making this deal with this guard saying, test us for 10 days. We'll eat the vegetables and drink the water and then test us. He had to be so sure that his God was going to come through for him and make him healthier and robust and look better than his counterparts who were enjoying the king's, you know, plentiful and really good food. He had to be so sure of his God and put so much faith in his God. NASB says, verse 15, in this way, this was NIV, but NASB says, at the end of 10 days, their appearance seemed better and they were fatter. They use the word fat. They were fatter than all the youths who had been eating the king's choice food. Now, I know that some of you may be thinking that at the end of the day, this is really kind of trivial, you know? This is kind of a mundane matter. What is the big deal about food? It's not like they're still in Jerusalem having to go to temple and observing all the laws and having to live by all the strict, you know, religious laws. There are no priests around that are trying to make sure that these young boys are keeping up with their strict dietary rules and laws and regulations. There's no priests checking on them. There are no parents around that are making sure over what they can and cannot eat, right? Think of your own kids. Think of your own kids for a second. When you're not around, to say what they can and cannot eat, and your children are offered this, you know, cornucopia of just lavish and amazing, great food, and you're not around, right? Kids will eat, kids will, you know, take of it, right? And think about them at this young age. These are young, you know, healthy, strapping lads. And have you seen young teenage boys eat? My goodness, they can eat a lot. So this goes to show just how faithful and committed Daniel and his friends were. Too often, I think that we let the what we think are the little things slide. We compromise on those little things. But we have to take a stand in all the little things in life today. We think that we will not compromise, so if someone comes and holds a gun to my head and says to me, I will shoot you if, you know, if you don't deny Christ. Or, you know, we make these you know, radical, huge, grandiose, you know, huge scenarios, right? Where we say, no, of course, I will not compromise. I will die for the Lord. I will, you know, lay down my life for the Lord. And, you know, we have all these convictions. And so often we let the little things slide, the little things that we think are insignificant and mundane, the little things in our lives. But I want to say that we have to learn to be faithful in those little things so that when we do face the big thing, we've had practice. We like to think that we are going to be strong and full of conviction and, you know, when the big things come, but I want to encourage us that it does begin with the little things. It does take training. It takes a mindset. And so with the little things, if we are faithful, when we are challenged and hit with the bigger things, we've had practice. And it will be more likely that we will be able to stand firm. Another issue. Second one is worship the king's idol. This other issue tested their convictions, and this was whether they would bow down to this golden idol, this golden image, or not. Let's look. Chapter 1. Oops. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold, 60 cubits high and 6 cubits wide, and set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. So King Nebuchadnezzar sets up this idol. It's gold. Then the herald loudly proclaimed, "Nations and peoples of every language, this is what you are commanded to do. As soon as you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipe, and all kinds of music, you must fall down and worship the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. Whoever does not fall down and worship will immediately be thrown into a blazing furnace." Another illustration. Do you see the, here's the golden image here, and there's the furnace that is smoking right there. And so it's very real before them. They're being able to see this right in front of them. Now, their lives are at risk. This is life or death. Matter. It's not just about counting calories. It's not just about food. It's not just about, you know, this small matter, but it is a life or death matter. And how do Meshach and Shadrach and Abednego respond? Here, verse 8 and 12. At this time, some astrologers came forward and denounced the Jews. The astrologers were those who were leaders and ones who worked in the palace for King Nebuchadnezzar. But there are some Jews whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who pay no attention to you, your majesty. They neither serve your gods nor worship the image of gold that you have set up. They refuse to worship the king's golden image. They hold to their convictions to the second commandment. The second commandment being, you shall not make for yourself any idol, nor bow down to it or worship it. That is the second commandment given, part of the Ten Commandments. Even in the face of death, they do not compromise. And then most of you know what happened, the rest of the story. King Nebuchadnezzar is furious, and he orders the three of them to be thrown into the fiery furnace to be burned alive. And this is what they say. Chapter 3, verses 16 through 18. This is what they say to the king. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego reply to him, "King Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If we're thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to deliver us from it, and he will deliver us from your majesty's hand. But even if he does not, we want you to know, your majesty, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold that you have set up." So they got thrown in, right? The king was true to his word. He's furious. He, in fact, ramps up the heat, makes it even hotter than normal, so that when they're bound up and taken, the soldiers take them near the furnace. You'll read in the Bible is that even the soldiers got burnt up because they got too close to the opening of the furnace. But when the king looks into the furnace, he sees not three men, but four. 24, 25. "Weren't there three men that we tied up and threw into the fire?" They replied, all his leaders, "Certainly, your majesty, that's true." And he said, King Nebuchadnezzar says, "Look, I see four men walking around in the fire, unbound and unharmed. And the fourth looks like a son of the gods." See this picture. He looks in and he says, "But wait a minute. Wasn't it three of them that we threw in there? How come I see four now?" The king told them to come out, and everyone that saw them saw that they were perfectly fine. There were no burns, no singed hair, no scorched robes. Not even the smell of smoke was on them at all. Not at all. And because King Nebuchadnezzar witnessed their faith and he witnessed this miracle, he declares in verse 28, King Nebuchadnezzar said, "Praise be to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and rescued his servants. They trusted him and defied the king's, commands, and they were willing to give up their lives rather than serve or worship any god except their own God." He goes, think about this, King Nebuchadnezzar goes from trying to kill them for not worshiping his golden idol to saying that anyone who speaks, oh, I didn't do 29. "Therefore, I decree that the people of any nation or language who say anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be cut into pieces and their houses be turned into piles of rubble, for no other God can save in this way." This is amazing. You guys have to understand. He goes from trying to kill them for not worshiping his golden image, his golden idol, to saying that anyone who speaks against their God, against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego's God, he will have them cut into pieces. This is amazing. The complete turnaround, right? Now we're getting to the final, most famous incident regarding the conviction and no compromise of Daniel. Yes, the famous lion's den, okay? So Daniel is no longer a young man, and he is under a different king. I don't know if you realize, there are some pictures and illustrations that still show Daniel as this young little, you know, teenage boy thrown into the lion's den. That's not true. Time has passed, a lot of time. He's not young, he's older, much older, and he's under a different king. Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians were defeated by King Darius, of the Medes, working with King Cyrus of Persia. So the Medes and the Persians, right? So the third issue that tested Daniel's conviction was obeying the king's law, which was to pray to the king only, to solely pray for the king only. The royal administrators, prefects, and satraps, advisors, and governors have all agreed that the king should issue an edict and enforce the decree that anyone who prays to any god or human being during the next 30 days, except to you, O King Darius, your majesty, shall be thrown into the lion's den. King Darius actually really liked Daniel. If you read the story, you find out that he really respects and honors Daniel because he sees that Daniel has special wisdom. He sees that there's something different about Daniel, actually really likes him. So much so that the other leaders and the officials in the palace and in the government, they're jealous of Daniel because King Darius keeps wanting to promote him and promote him. And so obviously there's jealousy going on. And so they're looking for ways to get rid of Daniel. Verses 4 and 5. The administrators and the satraps tried to find grounds for charges against Daniel in his conduct of government affairs, but they were unable to do so. They could find no corruption in him because he was trustworthy and neither corrupt nor negligent. Finally, these men said, "We will never find any basis for charges against this man, Daniel, unless it has something to do with the law of his God." Because they couldn't find anything corrupt in him, what do they go after? The one thing, his faith. The one thing that's right and good that they can go after. So they set a trap. They convince the king to issue this decree in writing. The decree is issued in writing, which means that it cannot be taken back. It cannot be repealed by anyone, not even the king himself. He can't nullify or void it once it's written out. He can't make any exceptions. The king can't even pardon anyone, right? So they trick him into writing this decree that for 30 days, everyone must only pray to him. And, you know, King Darius, he likes Daniel and stuff, but as most kings are, egomaniac. He has a huge ego. This sounds good to him. Okay, doesn't realize it's a trap and it's going to come bite him in the end. And, you know, his good, one of his favorite servants, Daniel, but he agrees to that. What was Daniel going to do? Would he compromise at the very real threat of being eaten by lions? So let's look at verse 10 here. Now, when Daniel learned that the decree had been published, he went home to his upstairs room where the windows opened toward Jerusalem. Three times a day, he got down on his knees and prayed, giving thanks to his God, just as he had done before. So he doesn't change a thing in his routine. He doesn't change a thing in his routine. Now, I think that we have to ask ourselves, would it have been compromising if he prayed with the windows shut? Would it have been compromising, let's say, if he prayed in a prayer closet in the dark with the, you know, away from this open window? Would it have been compromising if he just did that for the 30 days that the decree was, you know, active, right? After the 30 days, maybe he could go back to praying in front of the window. Would it have been compromising if he did those things? Well, that was not who Daniel was. That was not who Daniel was. That's not his style. It's not who he is. It's not who he was. The leaders and officials see him praying to his God, giving thanks to his God, and of course, they report him to King Darius. Verse 13. Then they said to the king, "Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah, he pays no attention to you, your majesty, or to the decree that you put in writing. He still prays three times a day." The king tries to find a loophole. He's desperate. He wants to find a loophole in his own law that he made, some way to save Daniel. But like I said, he cannot. So Daniel gets thrown into the lion's den overnight. And the king's last words to him before the opening of the den of the lions, before the opening of the den is shut, the king's last words that he shouts down to Daniel is, verse 16, "May your God, whom you serve continually, rescue you." That's what he says to him, shouts down to Daniel. "May your God, whom you serve continually, may he rescue you. May he come to your rescue. All right, good night." You know, and then it's shut, right? God sent his angel in the evening, during the night, to shut the mouths of the lions. So that when the king anxiously rushes back, when the king anxiously rushes back at the crack of dawn, he doesn't wait until later in the day, but he's up all night. The Bible says that he didn't get any sleep. He's so worried. He's so anxious about Daniel. At the crack of dawn, he runs back and he finds Daniel unharmed. Verse 23. Oh, I didn't show you the picture. Here's a photo. So King Darius shouting down to him, "May your God save you." And then he comes back. I don't know if this is before or after. Oh, probably in the morning. So in the morning, he comes back and sees that he is unharmed. The king was overjoyed, and he gave orders to lift Daniel out of the den. And when Daniel was lifted from the den, no wound was found on him because he had trusted in his God. Daniel and his friends could have easily compromised and gone along with everything in their new home, this foreign land of Babylon. After all, they were being treated great. They were being treated great. They were being treated like royalty. Yes, technically, they were prisoners. They were captives. But they were being treated, you know, and set up and trained to be future rulers here. They were probably having a better life in Babylon than they did back home in Jerusalem. Did you think about that? But they held on to their convictions and remained firm and faithful with their commitments and their obedience to their God, even in the midst of these challenges and temptations. And because of their life of no compromise, this lifestyle of no compromise, when they survived the fiery furnace, the three friends, you had this pagan king, King Nebuchadnezzar, declaring that anyone that speaks against their God, I will have you cut into pieces. And when Daniel survives the lion's den, you have another pagan king, King Darius, writing to everyone throughout the land. This is amazing. He writes to everyone throughout the land, King Darius, I issue a decree that in every part of my kingdom, people must fear and reverence the God of Daniel, for he is the living God, and he endures forever. His kingdom will not be destroyed. His dominion will never end. He rescues and he saves. He performs signs and wonders in the heavens and on the earth. He has rescued Daniel from the power of the lions. Amen. This is amazing. You have a pagan king decreeing this and writing this and sending it out all over the land to everybody who speaks all different languages, to all the people. And my question is, how are we living? Are we compromising? We definitely are living in the age of compromise. But how are we doing? Are we living in such a way that non-Christians see us and then they can declare that our God, the God that we serve, is real? That our God is the one true and living God? Can non-Christians see by our convictions, by our faith, by our actions of no compromise, can non-Christians point to us and point to our God and say, oh, wow, that is the real God. That is the living God. That's the God that rescues and saves. That's the God that performs signs and wonders. Because that's who our God is. And so often, because of our compromising and because of our letting the little things go, because of all this, non-Christians are unable to see that in us. Non-Christians are unable to declare that because they're not seeing it in us. When we live a life of no compromise, others will be affected. And that's how we are to be a witness. That's how we are to be a witness to this world. As the praise team comes up, you know, there's a lot of movies, a lot of movies where the scene happens where there's some sort of a battle, some sort of fight going on, and the person's losing, they're losing their strength, and they're pretty much almost dead. And then what happens? Usually someone says, you can do it, or someone says, you know, remember who you are, and stuff. So that happened in, I think, this movie called The Cinderella Man. I didn't watch it, but I was reading a synopsis about it. It happened in Cinderella Man. It also happened in Black Panther. Black Panther, really good movie. So you know that scene when it's challenge day and M'Baku of the Jabari tribe, they come and they challenge for the throne of Wakanda. They challenge for the rights to be Black Panther. Now, they're fighting and fighting, and then he's losing, okay? T'Challa is losing, and his mother says to him, show him who you are, right? And then he gets speared in the chest. And then what does he say? He says, I am Prince T'Challa, son of King T'Chaka, right? And from saying that, he gains strength and he comes and, you know, he ends up winning, right? So many movies happens that way where we're down and we're out, we're weakened, we're pretty beat up. And then someone reminds us, remember who you are. just the fact of remembering who I am and where I come from. I am a child of God. I am from the people of God. Just remembering that gives us such a surge of empowerment and energy and strength to withstand temptation, to withstand the challenges that come. When we are weak, we're forgetting who we are. We are forgetting that we are royalty. We're forgetting our heritage and who we are at all. But again, you can scene after scene in various movies plays over and over again. Remember who you are. And then they get strengthened. They, you know, rise up and they're able to defeat and win the day. My encouragement to you in these stories of Daniel and his friends, remember who you are. Remember whose you are. And the power and the living God who stands before us and called us his children and his friends. And when we remember that, we're able to stand firm with no compromise when things come, whether it's the small things and then the big things come, that we have practiced enough, that we have the mindset of being able to live a life of no compromise. Let's all stand.